Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the celebrated and distinguished scientists Dr. Francine Berman, Dr. Justine Cassell, Dr. Tracy Camp. These outstanding researchers and educators will talk about their recent tour of China, speaking about emerging technologies in computing. In part one of these series, all of these renowned researchers describe their roles and the different kinds of objectives that they have, and what triggered their interest in computing, and then went on to describe some of the early aspects of doing their tour of China, including talking about their topics of interest, and they also talked about the makeup of their audiences. So we'll continue that discussion. So for the three of you then, what was most notable about the experiences with the hosts?
Well, this is Justine. I'll say that we were very lucky to experience the legendary Chinese hospitality in each of the venues that we visited. We were met at the airport. We were brought to wonderful and interesting hotels, two of which were actually inside the universities where we were speaking, but which were nothing like the guest houses, the small guest houses that I've seen in the past. They were great hotels. And we were guests at traditional Chinese banquets with 25 to 30 different regional dishes, a really true intercultural and warm interpersonal experience. We were also taken on tours of each of the cities or the universities, and that was particularly interesting in Guangzhou, where the South China University of Technology is located on an island. And that island also houses a kind of a theme park about the history of South China. That was really fun. We got to watch a mock old-fashioned style wedding. We got to see the way that China would have functioned in Guangzhou 100 or 200 years ago. But overall, each of our hosts truly went above and beyond what was necessary to make us feel comfortable. And part of that was to assign to us two wonderful young women, Lisa and Jessica, who served as interpreters when we needed interpreters in airports and restaurants and other travel situations, and who served as guides for the places where we were going. And they were wonderful in their own right and wonderfully helpful.
I think Justine sums it up great. We had a terrific time, and our hosts were just wonderful. They really went out of their way to make us feel welcome and show us China and introduce us to people, and it was just terrific.
So, Frank, can you talk about your added lectures at HUST?
Yes. I had a great time giving an added lecture in Wuhan, and my colleague, Professor Hai Jin, that I had met elsewhere, actually I had met him in Italy at a GRID workshop, had invited me to give an extra lecture. So our joint lectures were in the afternoon, and then I spent the morning giving a lecture to his group, which was a rather large group, and visiting he and some of his colleagues. And it was interesting for me because I didn't want to give the same lecture twice. So in the morning lecture, I actually focused on some of SDSC's cyber infrastructure, some issues around high-performance computing and grid computing, and really spent the morning focusing not so much on data and the afternoon spending more time talking about data. Professor Jin was just terrific. I got a chance to chat with some of the folks doing some of the storage technologies there, and of course he's been very involved in China Grid and high performance computing, both in China and certainly in Wuhan. And so I just had a great time being able to chat with them and being able to meet some of the people in certainly areas of my specialization.
Do you see sort of the day within, let's say, the next 5 years of exaflop computing?
Yes. That's a very interesting thing that I think scientists in high-performance computing all around the world are very interested in, as well as application scientists, because today we're seeing the deployment of petascale machines, and, of course, people are starting to think about exascale, which is the next rung on the ladder. And it's interesting, not just in terms of the computer architectures and how you actually make that many processors work simultaneously and provide the kind of efficiency you want, but it's a real challenge for applications researchers as well to try to create the codes that can take advantage of those machines, to try to manage huge amounts of data that you're likely to see as input, as output, and during computations. The software environments for these kinds of machines are tremendously challenging. Hooking them up on grids is tremendously challenging. So I got an opportunity to talk to my colleagues in that community, but really scientists all over the world are starting to think about exaflop computing. And we haven't even mastered petaflop computing yet. So this is, of course, standard for science to always look at the next horizon. But it's a tremendously exciting time for people in high-performance computing.
So, Tracy, what can you share about your visit to the museum in Wuhan?
Yeah, so when I think back of our tour to China, I have many wonderful memories that I'll definitely have for a lifetime. And one of these memories was this museum trip that I had the pleasure of going on. Before the trip to China, I actually had mentioned to a colleague of mine from New Zealand who was visiting me in the United States that I was going to China. His name is Tim Bell. And it turned out that Tim actually spends a month almost every single year at HUST in Wuhan. And he had become really, really good friends with two professors in computer science at HUST, Enmi Song and Hong Lu. And Professor Song and Lu were excited that I was coming to visit and that I knew Tim, who they obviously, really, really enjoyed his visits as well. And so the two of them offered to take me to this museum in the Wuhan area. It's the Hubei Provincial Museum, so a very large museum for that area. And the time that we spent there, we didn't have a lot of time at the museum, but the time that we spent there is definitely something I'm going to remember for a long time. We saw many very interesting artifacts from years and hundreds of years ago, but the thing that really stands out to me the most is we saw a tomb of a former king. So this tomb was actually buried in about 433 B.C., so before Christ, 400 years before Christ, it was buried. And then it was accidentally discovered just in 1977. And the artifacts within this tomb were amazingly well-preserved. So back in 400 B.C., when you had someone as important as a king pass on, what they did back then was they had these huge tombs, and they would bury with the king many things that the king could then use in his afterlife. And so this particular tomb that they found contained four chambers or rooms. One room contained the Marquis Yi's coffin, a very, very large coffin. Another room contained 21 other coffins. Another room contained items that had to do with armor and weapons and war. Apparently, this king lived during the warring period, and so he had a lot of war and was a good fighter with his soldiers. And then the last room just contained several luxury items that the king and the other women that were buried with them could use in their afterlife. So, yeah, just this huge, huge tomb that they accidentally found just 30 years ago. So that was definitely a highlight of the stop in Wuhan for me.
So it sounds like you got a great exposure to this sort of longest continuous civilization that exists on this planet.
Oh, yeah, it was fabulous. And actually, one other thing that was in the tomb that I thought was very interesting was they found a set of 65 bronze bells. And apparently, this is the largest bronze musical instrument that has ever been discovered and requires five people to play this set of bells. And at the museum, on the wall, they actually show how each bell matches to a key on a piano. And so you can just imagine that, this was their piano back in 400 B.C.
It's kind of amazing, this the sort of the engineering required to just put this all together.
Yeah, and then also I think just tremendously amazing at how well preserved these artifacts were. I mean, it was definitely a highlight of the trip to stop there. Anyone who visits the Wuhan area should definitely stop at the Hubei Provincial Museum.
So all of you talked about earlier about, you know, doing this tour and involving with faculty, and I imagine that the questions the faculty have in China are really the same questions that you're dealing with today, because it's such a global, merged community of scientists and thinkers and thought leaders. But in terms of the questions about the from the students, do you have anything to say about that, the kinds of questions that the students asked?
This is Justine, and I agree with you that the questions asked by the faculty were very similar to questions that would be asked by faculty in any talk I believe we would give anywhere in the world. As far as the students were concerned, we were really struck by their professional drive and the fact that the undergraduates were already planning what it would take to get into graduate school, including getting into graduate school in the United States. So we were asked many questions about the best kinds of classes to take, the best kinds of techniques to study. For example, I was asked if a class in logic would help with learning natural language processing later on. We were also, of course, asked questions about our research, and we were struck by how carefully these students had listened and how well they had integrated the information in our talks given in a foreign language by people who speak fairly rapidly. So one young woman, for example, listened to our talks and then asked me probably the hardest question I could be asked. And that is, when virtual children play with real children, do the benefits that accrue to the real children from playing with the virtual children transfer to play between two real children? That's called the transfer question, and it's a very sophisticated question. And this young woman was either an undergraduate or an early graduate student. And I was very impressed with the fact that over the course of a short talk, she could understand well enough to come up with that very tough question.
Most of the questions we were asked were technical questions or questions about the U.S., but we also got some very interesting and surprising personal questions. And for me, one of the most, this is Fran, for me, one of the most surprising questions we got was in Guangzhou, and someone asked me about how much time I spent being director of SDSC. And I thought that was really interesting, and I felt like my answer was that it was, of course, a very time-intensive set of professional responsibilities and a very engaging job. But I also wanted to mention to the student that I have a family, I have two children, I spent a lot of time with my family, and that it's really important to me to both, you know, take my job very seriously and spend a lot of time on it, but it's also really important to me to have a real life as well. And during our various presentations, Tracy also stressed the importance of integrating both job and family and showed pictures of her kids, etc. And I think that was a good message to be able to send, because I think all of us, you know, men and women, struggle with these issues of balancing a very engaging career and very important family interactions. So it was interesting to me that someone had asked that question.
Yeah, that was, this is Tracy, yeah, that was a great question to ask. And we particularly enjoyed the questions that we received from the students, both during our presentations as well as the students that came up and talked to us after the presentations were over. And we actually said to ACM that we suggest the next time they do one of these speaking tours that they also include a panel of just for the students to talk about these types of professionalization type questions and life work integration type questions, and you know, what do you need to do to get ahead and succeed, and those types of career type questions. And I'm sure whomever ACM recruits to do a tour like this again, hopefully the three of us, but whoever gets recruited, I'm sure would be happy to serve on this type of panel, and I think the students would really appreciate it.
You know, that's interesting because I was thinking that it'd be great to integrate that with CCTV, China Central Television, which worldwide has an audience of 1 billion. And, you know, we have American Idol here where you can get an audience of, say, 30 or 40 million. They can have a program which has an audience of 400 million. And
wow.
I know Hugh Young, who's the, he's one of the directors and producers with China Central Television, and it may be worth having some of this televised as well, going on across the country. And in fact, they have an English language division as well, and it could be also produced around the world. So it may be a thought.
ACM videotaped all of the presentations, so I know that they're planning on making those available.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, it just I'm just fascinated by the sort of interchange that occurred with the students and so on, and this idea that the students are, you know, they're operating in a second language, and yet they're integrating all this information. It kind of ties in with Bloom's taxonomy, you know, of cognitive sort of learning, where they, you know, like knowledge application, analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. And here you have these students working at that student and evaluation level, integrating in another language as you're talking. So so I guess your experiences are that their English was very good.
Their English seemed to be fairly good. Of course, there was a range of abilities in English, but there were a number of students who spoke really excellent English.
Yeah, this is Tracy, and I was extremely impressed by the quality of the English and how well they understood our lectures in order to be able to ask some, you know, really good technical type questions. So I was extremely impressed by that. Certainly their English far, far surpasses any ability I have in the Chinese languages.
So I guess Justine, with her linguistic background, would serve as sort of the partial interpreter sometimes.
Well, partial interpreter is definitely saying too much, but I did try. I downloaded 25 iPod lessons, and every morning I would listen to an iPod lesson and then practice my Chinese on the hostess in the breakfast restaurant and the cab driver and anybody else we ran into, and they were remarkably patient with me.
And I guess especially because Chinese Mandarin is a tonal language, so, you know, just a slight difference in intonation could mean goodbye or hello or bad or good.
That's correct. Unlike English, which uses intonation to mark emphasis or emotion, Chinese uses tones, those same up and down sounds, to mark meaning. And that's what makes it difficult to learn.
So, you know, getting on to then, you know, what did you find were the key differences between Chinese universities and U.S. universities?
So this is Tracy. So let me talk a little bit about at least one difference that I learned about when I did that museum outing with Professor Song and Professor Liu from HUST in Wuhan. I actually asked them a number of questions about how students get into universities, and what I learned from them, and I hope I actually, you know, understood what they were describing, but what I took away from our conversation, that one significant difference between Chinese universities and U.S. universities is the fact that in China, a student will complete one college application for the whole country. Here in the United States, of course, our students complete many applications based on the colleges that they're hoping to be admitted to. But in China, a student completes one application, and then within this application, a student will rank several universities. I think it was three universities that he or she would like to attend, and then the student will also rank majors that the student is interested in majoring in at university. And then the student takes this exam, which I bet most of your listeners have heard of, this very large national type exam that students take in China. And then the universities use that exam score to determine which university the student is admitted to. So that's extremely different than how it works in the United States.
Another thing we thought was interesting is that in the professor ranks for the most part in the United States, when you become a professor, you can supervise students and teach courses and do the whole raft of things. Of course, you move through your own merit process. But in Chinese universities, some of our hosts shared with us that the faculty that can supervise students are only some of the professors. And there's some set of criteria and some process to go through until one can formally advise students, so that the more senior professors seem to be able to have to be able to advise students, and then some of the more junior professors could not yet formally be students' advisors, which I thought was very interesting.
So any other comments, Justine?
No, I think that covers it. Very interesting difference. Actually, I would add one thing that I was struck by. I was struck and fascinated by how young the highly placed professors were. So we met a number of deans, associate provosts, vice provosts, and all of these faculty members were in their 40s. And of course, that's the result of the Mao Zedong Cultural Revolution and the reform through labor campaigns in the mid-1970s, where professors were sent to the fields to be re-educated. That whole generation of professors, many of them never came back to work in the university, and the positions they would have held today as deans and provosts, as vice presidents, are therefore held by much younger faculty members.
So it's just sort of fascinating, you know, the differences between here and in China in terms of the universities and the teaching and so on. I was struck by this idea of this one exam, and I imagine the scores must have been pretty amazing to get into universities like Tsinghua.
Yeah, from my understanding, this is Tracy, yeah, you have to be in the top echelon in order to get into a university such as Tsinghua. So, I'm sure the students study extremely hard for that exam and, work a lot of hours to prepare for that exam. And if it doesn't go well, you have to wait a whole nother year before you can retake the exam. So tremendous, tremendous pressure to do well on that one exam.
Well, and there also seems to be a really interesting process whereby they match students to universities. And as they were describing it, it almost sounded like what we do with students in medical schools, where there's a matching process between where you'll go and, your set of choices. It was a really interesting set of processes.
Yeah, that's a good point, the correlation with the medical school, Fran.
You know, I attended a conference, and in fact, I spoke at it earlier this year, and there were executives from some of the world's largest organizations and corporations, and one of them, based out of India, indicated that they graduate 450,000 engineers a year, and other executives there indicated that China graduates over 700,000. And I know there was this research study indicating that in 2010, 90% of the world's engineers and scientists will be in the Asia region. So I guess you got sort of a taste of some of that because you see a lot of this sort of entrepreneurial research interest, a lot of this sort of drive for scholarship and so on that's sort of inherent in that culture.
This is Fran. I've actually found that one of my colleagues was talking to me about this, and I actually found the Chinese perspective was really interesting because of the kinds of birth control policies that they have in China. This person noted that they don't have those kinds of policies in India, and they were thinking about, distribution of resources for populations that big and wondering if India was going to hit some of the same limitations that on resources that the Chinese have.
So some really interesting questions to think about.
Yeah.
So, what are the opportunities then for U.S. researchers in China?
Well, this is Fran. I'll go ahead and talk about this. They were enormously interested in exchange programs. And a number of people talked to us about, short, medium, longer-term visits between U.S. researchers and Chinese researchers, both at the student and the faculty level. And I think those kinds of exchange programs, which, of course, you know, happen informally through people going to school in the U.S. or something like that, you know, really keep kind of the scientific boundaries very low. And in fact, some of our hosts in Guangzhou were very interested in having Tracy come back. There seemed to be a particular preponderance of folks interested in networking there and sensors, and they were talking to Tracy about coming back for a month or so on an exchange program. Tracy, you might want to say more about that.
Yeah, so from my understanding, China has this national program to try and bring native English-speaking faculty to China to teach upper-level courses in computer science and I'm sure in other fields as well. So it sounds like a really interesting program. The little bit I understand about it is that they help cover all your local costs while you're at the university, and then you teach this course. The timing of the lectures of the course, from my understanding, is extremely flexible. I think you're supposed to teach, it's like 30 hours of course material or something over a, you know, 4 or 5 week period. And so, yeah, this national program, I definitely would like to take advantage of this in China, not just because I'd like to return myself to China and continue the, you know, the collaboration that we started with these universities, but also because I just would really love to take both my husband and my children to China and let them experience some of what I got to experience on this tour.
So this is Fran again. Let me also point out that most of the researchers we met certainly had been outside of China to the U.S. and Europe and elsewhere for various conferences and workshops. And, you know, like researchers in the U.S., we all travel all over the world to meet with other folks in our particular domains. Some of them mentioned that the visa process could be a little bit challenging at times, but they were very sophisticated. And in that sense, in the sense of, you know, science being a global enterprise, no different than the U.S. researchers.
So what then sort of really impressed each one of you about China?
So this is Tracy. I'll go ahead and go first. And I think for me, as Justine mentioned, we had the honor of experiencing the Chinese hospitality, and that definitely impressed me quite a bit. While we were there at all three of the regions that we visited, we were treated like royalty, and our hosts worked really hard to predict our every need and then meet those needs, and it was fabulous to be treated like that. I've never been treated like that previously. And even in at our museum tour, I even had someone ask to take, and this was a Chinese student who must have been about 17 years old or something, she asked to take a picture with me. So I kind of felt like a rock star. I had that moment of rock star feeling.
You are a rock star, Tracy.
We all think you're a rock star.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
This is Fran. I'll go next. I thought one of the things that really impressed me about China was the juxtaposition, you know, right in the same place of technology sophistication and very traditional approaches. And we saw that everywhere we went. There would be, the Beijing airport was amazing. There would be these tremendously sophisticated technologies and buildings and architectures, et cetera, and right next door would be a traditional noodle house. And it was amazing. I think one of the places you see this the most are in the roadways. You see people, you know, driving cars and biking and walking and somehow not killing each other all the time. And it was pretty interesting to see just this very direct juxtaposition everywhere you looked.
Yes, this is Justine. I would add that juxtaposition was, in fact, really fascinating. And it led to something that made me very happy, which was that near these very high-tech universities, one could find some very old-fashioned traditional food stalls. And I'm a real foodie, so I ended up sneaking out early in the morning and late at night so that I could hit the stalls in the back alleys of Beijing, for example, near the Hutong, the traditional courtyard homes, so that I could taste some of the specialties, street specialties that China is known for. Likewise, in Wuhan, I snuck out early in the morning to go to a place called the Breakfast Street so that I could eat Reigan Mian noodles and other breakfast specialties. So I loved that. And I also loved the intensity of the faculty that we interacted with, their passion for their research, their passion for collaboration, their passion to meet people from other places and to forge bonds.
Definitely our most adventurous eater.
Well, I'm intrigued now, Justine. You must have tried things that were particularly exotic.
I did. I tried many exotic things. But I'm a pretty exotic eater. I tried from one of the stalls in Wuhan, I tried snails. Those were yummy. Kind of steamed snails with a kind of black bean sauce. I tried a wonderful kind of dim sum dumpling that had the soup inside. And that was really cool because we got to watch them make it. We put in our order. I went with Lisa, one of our interpreters, and we put in our order, and then the cooks behind the counter made the dumplings while we watched. They actually rolled out the dough, cut them into circles, and somehow inside that circle of dough, they put wild mushrooms and a tablespoon of soup and then steamed the dumplings, and you had to eat the dumplings in one big bite so that it didn't squirt all over. That was one of the best foods I tasted during our trip.
For me, the best food was those traditional Beijing noodles. Oh, man, that dish was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you could do a food show.
Oh, we could do a food show, yep.
You will be the host of that one.
Be happy to do the research for it.
And all the tasting.
Yeah, exactly. That counts in the research.
Well, you know, each one of you have these amazing careers and very distinguished over a long period of time. So what are your top three lessons that you want to share with the broad audience?
Fran?
Top three lessons. First of all, I think you have to do what you really care about, what you're really passionate about. I think that's tremendously important. At the end of the day, every professional career has things that are really joyful and things that are really challenging. And if you're not spending your very precious time and effort on things that you really care about, I think that's, for me, that's a non-starter. So that's one of the, I think that's the topmost lesson for me. I'll share two other things that when people ask me questions like this, that I often say because I really believe in this. And I think two really important skills to have are to be very strategic in your approach and to develop a tough skin. And let me just talk about those for a little bit. I think that I make a practice myself, and I think it's wise to think about the Gretzky rule. You want to be skating to where the puck will be, and it's really important to try to think about what's the holistic environment, where are things going, and how can you be strategic in getting there. And that's true whether you're a beginning graduate student and you're trying to focus your efforts on having the best possible resume so that when you get out of grad school, you'll be able to get a job, to a very senior professional trying to solve various and sundry problems at your workplace. Developing a tough skin, I think, is another important thing. In professional life, there are very difficult things and there are very enjoyable things, and I think all of us, men and women, need to have a tough skin and not take things personally as they occur. I think that's especially important for women, as I think that often we're acculturated to take things personally and feel like, boy, there's a roadblock there, you know, how do I get around it? And I think you just have to move through it or around it or under it or over it or to try to be strategic about your approach. But I think developing a tough skin is very important for all professionals. And so for me, that third thing is very important.
This is Tracy. The interesting thing to me, I think it illustrates how well we got along when we were in China. My top three are actually the exact three that Fran mentioned. I think it's extremely important to follow your passion. I learned that in the earlier question that we talked about of our greatest or our biggest decision we made that had an impact on our career. I definitely learned that, it's tremendously important to follow your passion, to not only have a good time, but then also to be successful. Two, I think it's also, I agree with Fran, to focus and be strategic in what you do. That'll take you far. And then lastly, to persevere, even in the face of multiple rejections, persevering is needed. Having that tough skin and persevering and moving forward, I think are also three, another lesson to know. So in thinking about, because Fran mentioned those three, let me throw out three more that I also think are very important lessons that I've learned along the way. One is the importance of having a mentor. When I was a junior faculty member, I didn't have a mentor, and I think it took me a lot longer to move forward and really, understand this job and move forward. So I would just advise all your listeners that if they can't think of a couple mentors that they have off the top of their head, then they need to go in search of finding some mentors to help them think about their career and their strategies and solve problems and those types of issues. I think it's just extremely important to have a mentor. A second thing I think is important of what I had to learn anyways that I didn't do early on in my career is how important it is to network. And I think women in particular are more task-oriented. And so a lot of us might not see networking as actually part of our job. But I had one woman who actually spoke at a conference on the importance of networking, and she actually pointed out that work is part of the word network. So networking is part of our job, and so I think women need to keep that in mind, that, it's not, networking is not a task. You can actually check off of did that, but it is part of our job that you need to do in order to move forward in your career. And then the last thing that I had to learn in my career is the importance of just scheduling fun and scheduling downtime, scheduling time away from the computer and away from work. I totally love my job, and I could, let it completely pervade my life if I allowed it to. And so I actually had to learn that I need to schedule some time away. And actually I found by, having this balance away from work actually allows me to be more efficient and effective in the work that I do.
And I would add to that, sorry, I kind of put this on mute so you wouldn't hear my coughing fit. I would add to that that much like Fran and Tracy have said, be passionate about your work. Choose a topic because it's an important topic to the field, but also because you're passionate about it, because it keeps you up at night. Because you're going to be working really, really hard, and that hard work had better make you happy. I would also say that the value of perseverance can't be underestimated. Get a tough skin, but also keep pushing forward. I would say that we sometimes undersell the importance of collaboration to our students. It's important to collaborate. When students are in school, we reward them for the work they do on their own. When they become professionals, they're rewarded for their collaborations. And finally, I would say be a role model. Start being a role model from the time you're an undergraduate. Help younger students. When you're a graduate student, help undergraduates. When you're a junior faculty member, help graduate students. And then maybe I would say one more thing, which certainly has to do with the work that I do, and that is boundaries between fields and within fields are made to be broken. Good scientists don't believe in the status quo. That's what makes them good scientists.
There's a great selection of advice here, and I noticed that some of them sort of coincide with a talk I had with Marielle Clavé, and she gave her sort of her top tips for success or just for living life and doing well and things like that. And it's amazing how there's so much sort of, you know, alignment with those kinds of thoughts that she had as well. You know, there's something else that occurred. You know, I had a discussion with Barbara Liskov. She talked about this whole idea of unconscious bias. Do you have any viewpoints on that?
This is Tracy, and I think, you know, I am not an expert in this field, but I have, you know, read that there have been some studies that have been done that illustrates that unconscious bias does exist. I can think of one study in particular where there were identical resumes that were created, identical resumes, but John was changed to Jill at the top of the page, and then this resume was given to, you know, a lot of people, both men and women, and the end result was the John resume received higher score than the Jill resume. So that's just one study that I remember hearing about. So I think that the, you know, unconscious bias does exist, and I think that what we just need to just be aware of it in the hope that making our world more aware of the potential for unconscious bias will help us then overcome any unconscious bias that we might personally have. And this is true for both men and women. The unconscious biases exist. And I also just would like to say that when I think about the, you know, the opportunities and the biases that exist for my mom, you know, way back when she was a young woman versus, you know, what exists for me today, and then what might exist, you know, for when my daughter becomes a young woman. And, you know, I think that at least the scale of unconscious bias, in my opinion, seems to be diminishing, although I don't have any scientific proof of that, but at least it seems to me that that is the case.
I would add, this is Justine speaking, I would add that one of the things that we hope to achieve through our trip to China was to represent women as top computer scientists. So we know that there's a representation effect, that students having access and seeing women in top positions, just that fact can change their beliefs about who can be a computer scientist. And of course, we all hoped that by being at the front of the room, by giving talks about the cutting edge of the field, that women students in the room would begin to think that they could make it to the top, and that men students in the room would begin to think about women being able to make it to the top. And we did that in an implicit way.
This is Fran, and I think that's really important. When Tracy mentioned this trip to me, one of the things that I really loved about it was that Tracy said, we would like to send some top computer scientists to China, and I was very flattered that she included me. She didn't say to me, we want to send some top women computer scientists to China. And I really love the fact that we went, I really love the fact that we went as top computer scientists. We didn't go as women computer scientists. I mean, the fact that we're women computer scientists is, of course, true. But there was no, what am I trying to say? You know, there was no special category. We just went as top computer scientists. I also wanted to mention that I think unconscious bias goes beyond gender. And my own experience is there's often an unconscious bias about leadership styles. So if you think about it, leadership is really about getting strategic things done. And I think oftentimes we think of leaders as being people that take, you know, relatively conventional and traditional approaches, but there really is a variety of different leadership styles. And I think that it's important to think about what we want to be the outcome of leadership, what we want to accomplish through leadership, and not just what particular style we're comfortable with.
Well, I thank you all for sharing your insights in this area, and especially because you are outstanding leaders and visionaries and thought leaders and scientists as well and educators. So just amazing contributions over a lifetime, and it just adds to this whole idea of excellence. So again, thank you. I'd like to also now shift gears and get your what you think are the top three predictions for the future, their implications, and how people can best prepare.
This is Justine, and my prediction for the future arises from the research that I do. I believe that the boundaries between fields will blur, and in particular the boundaries between computer science and some of the other fields nearby will blur. The boundaries between computer science and biology, the boundaries between computer science and psychology. And for that latter one, I think we need to keep in mind that human-centered computing is going to become essential. We're no longer in an era where we can afford to make cool gadgets and hope they'll sell. With this economy and with this knowledge of technology in the general population, we need to be building technologies that are adopted by people who need them and want them. And there, I note that some of the most successful technologies are being built by people of the age that the technology is targeted to. Facebook was built by a college student who was very aware of college students' need and desire for networking and friendship. So unless we take into account the needs, the desires, the beliefs, and the behaviors of people, we're not going to be able to design the best IT for the future.
This is Fran, and I have to say I really agree with a lot of what Justine said, and they would certainly reflect my three thoughts on emerging trends as well. I would say that number one, what excites me is there's increasing integration between the physical, biological, and cyber worlds. If you think about the emerging work we're doing with implanted medical devices and finger sensors on your computer and all of these kinds of things, all of this will increase dramatically in the next 10 or 20 years, and I think we will increasingly see these cyber, physical, biological systems that provide very different kinds of environments and immense opportunities and challenges. So I think there will be lots more of that. The second trend I see is the deluge of data will not stop. They say we will have Avogadro's number amount of data by 2023. And I think it's becoming increasingly important to be able to transform raw amounts of data to usable information and knowledge. If you think about all the information embedded in your email and various and sundry other data caches that you have, it's actually often hard to really figure out what you want to based on all of that. This is particularly true, I think, in the health sciences, where imagine that it's very easy and cost-effective to map our personal genomes. How are we going to develop some personalized medicines and treatments and things like that based on that? So the whole transformation from data to knowledge, I think, is a very important trend and will require all kinds of particular things, algorithms. It will involve, new systems. It will involve regulation. It will involve a lot of stuff. The third trend that I see, and again, I want to say that I think Justine and I are in mind meld on this, is just looking at today's very agile social networks, the Facebooks and the LinkedIns and the, you know, Flickers and, you know, all kinds of things that people are using to create very agile groupings, to tag things in personalized ways, et cetera. I also think they're going to have tremendous impact in terms of the generations that will be leading us in 10 or 20 years. There's a bunch of pictures of kids playing beer pong on Facebook today, and some of those guys will want to run for office, be leaders, scientists, CEOs of tomorrow. I think our notion of what's private and what's not, how we interact with each other, will be very different. If you think about it, 20 years ago, Barack Obama was in law school. 20 years ago, the guy who started Facebook was in preschool. So this is coming up fast, and today's generation will really be taking the reins for us from us pretty soon. And they have a bunch of tools that I think many of us did not have and are just trying to become facile with.
Yeah, this is Tracy, and let me just add on to what Fran was saying. It just amazed me how my children took for granted that I was sitting in China and we could have a video conference call. That just amazed me. You know, they're so used to technology of today, things like Skype and other things that they have available that, you know, we didn't even have the internet back when we were growing up, at least not, you know, accessible to us anyways. So that just, yeah, it amazes me how technology has moved forward over just the last several decades. Both Fran and Justine talked about the importance of interdisciplinary research, and that is definitely a prediction for the future, is we're going to see more and more interdisciplinary work. Interdisciplinary is definitely our future, and I think this is extremely exciting because we as computer scientists get to step outside of our box and learn about other fields. This is particularly even true within my own work. We recently were funded with a very large National Science Foundation grant that is going to take wireless sensor devices and apply them to things that we've referred to as geosystems, so things like underground tunnels and bridges and anything that we construct as humans that actually interface with the Earth, dams, underground tunnels, those types of things. And this research project is going to look at the technology challenges that exist in order to use wireless sensor devices on these geosystems. So I get to work with a civil engineer and an environmental engineer and a geophysicist and, you know, other people very, very far from computer science. And that just adds a lot of, I think, excitement to the research that I'm doing. Also within my own field, I think a prediction for the future is just this whole notion of ubiquitous computing, that we are going to have computing anytime and anywhere that we want to have computing. We're going to start seeing more and more smart homes come on. We're going to start seeing more and more body nets where we actually have sensor devices placed on a body to monitor the physical aspects of a human being. So that's definitely within my own field a prediction for the future. Another prediction that is quite a bit outside of my field, but definitely something that we're going to continue seeing in the future, is just the processing power that casual users of computers will have at their fingertips. Today, if you buy a brand new laptop, you know, you can get a laptop with dual cores, and I think even the quad-core laptops are available now, or if they're not, they probably will be very in the near future. And I remember talking with someone from Intel, and she joked about a future of a 64-core laptop. And, you know, maybe that's not so much of a joke. Maybe our laptops are all going to have this tremendous processing power just at our fingertips for both, you know, major computer users like Fran, Justine, and I, and then also the casual users such as my mom. And so then the big kind of technical question is, how can we use that processing power in an efficient manner? And I think a lot of researchers are working on that question, but I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Stacy, this is Fran. It amuses me to think that SDSC's very first supercomputer is about the size of today's Xbox. So I think what you're saying is definitely true.
Yeah, I heard that the processing power that we have in an iPod, I think, is more than was in the first Apollo launch.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
That may or may not be true.
Or a PS3, actually, I think, has 8 cores in it, right? Or 7 cores and one's a spare, so.
Wow.
So it just shows you where things are going. You know, I really enjoyed this interview, and you're just an amazing group of distinguished scientists, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you today, and especially with your demanding schedule. So I thank you for coming in and sharing your wisdom with the audience.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Stephen. This was a pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with the celebrated and distinguished scientists, Dr. Francine Berman, Dr. Justine Cassell, and Dr. Tracy Camp.